Raw, I'd oftentimes go back to my hotel room and watch that nice replay of Nitro. And I always thought, why are we losing to this? I didn't like us getting beaten 83 weeks in a row, but I wasn't going to dwell on it because my thought was, we have a chance to play another game on Monday. With all the duties I was handling, I didn't have time to grieve. I was busy doing payroll for 100-plus members of talent and playing the role of priest, guidance counselor, 12-step sponsor, and the school principal as needed. I could feel the momentum turn into our favor, and I was happy with that. Right around WrestleMania 14, we also debuted Sean Waltman, who made his name previously in WWF as the 1-2-3 Kid, but was now reintroduced as X-Pac, the newest member of DX. That was significant because it was the first high-profile NWO member to defect to WWF. While some people were looking to come back to WWF, others were looking to work there for the first time. Dr. Death Steve Williams had made it as a major star in Japan, but after a decade of doing most of his wrestling there, Doc was looking to spend more time in the States. Another factor that he regrettably was not as forthcoming about was his body was carrying the effects of years of wrestling his intensely physical style, especially in Japan. Doc still looked like a tank, but he was only human, like the rest of us. Although I didn't know quite how worn down his body was, I did know he was a 16-year veteran with a style no one could mistake for easy. Doc reminded me of Vader, where I felt we got him a little too late to really get the most out of him. I was hoping to get one good run out of Doc, which would not only help the company, but also get Doc a nice payday. And then came the Brawl for All. When I got the word from Creative, I detested it immediately. I understood that the fans might wonder who would really win a fight between wrestler A and wrestler B, but for us to try it was plain stupid. It immediately created dissension in the locker room as guys took sides with each new matchup. Not to mention that it caused injuries that cost the company a lot of money in medical bills and lost revenue, and it did not benefit any of the participants. Even the winner ultimately lost out as a result of participating. Doc was one of the 16 entrants, and with his credentials as a four-time wrestling All-American at the University of Oklahoma, Doc was one of the favorites to win it all. In a second-round bout with Bart Gunn, Doc tore his quad during the third round of the fight. The muscle came off the bone and rolled up his leg. I had no idea how Doc was even standing after that, but he wouldn't quit. So he got the shit beat out of him pretty quickly by Bart, a tough man in his own right. Doc was literally a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. Doc was never the same after that, and because he was seen as JR's boy, because we were both from Oklahoma, both came up through Mid-South, and we were friends outside of the business. Because of this, some people began spreading the BS that I now somehow had it in for Bart Gunn, which was 100% untrue. It probably didn't help that Doc told people in the locker room that he had already been paid the winner's cash prize. I began to hear that I was so mad at Bart Gunn for beating Doc that I personally went out and booked Butterbean to fight Gunn at WrestleMania 15. Butterbean was Eric Esch, a super heavyweight boxer who had come from the world of tough man contests, mixed martial arts, K-1, and Pride. Even though Bean had more than 150 pounds on Bart, the idea was for both men to battle in one last shoot boxing match for the company. Not only was this not my idea, but if I'd been asked, I would have objected strongly. Nothing against Butterbean, who was really a nice guy, but I didn't understand why we were taking the only guy who had gotten anything positive from that stupid tournament and risking what little momentum that he had. Butterbean came to me before the fight, the day of Mania, and asked me, "Hey, are you guys going to be mad at me if I knock Bark Gunn out in the first round. He was concerned about it because he was considering getting into wrestling and didn't want to burn a bridge. Well, this is supposed to be real, Bean, so you do what you got to do. No one's going to be mad at you, I said. Privately, I was thinking, don't underestimate Bark Gunn. There's a lot of people in that locker room who think Bart's going to knock the barbecue out of the butter bean. Bart was in great shape, had that devastating left hand with a reach advantage, and had gone through the guys in Brawl for All like salt through a widowed woman, as my granddad used to say. A lot of the guys in the locker room were actually taking bets, and more of them were looking to bet on Bart rather than the experienced Butterbean. It only took Butterbean 35 seconds to cost a lot of the locker room a decent amount of cash because he quickly and conclusively knocked out Bart. It wasn't a fluke. There was no lucky punch. As dangerous and powerful as Bart was, he was up against a guy who legitimately beat people up for a living. Bart was out of the company not long after, as was Doc. So with Brawl for All, we ended up creating zero stars, racking up thousands in medical bills, and even finding a way to make the winner look like a loser. It broke my heart to have to let Doc go, especially since it strained the friendship we'd built for nearly 20 years, as I knew it would. I understood why he was mad. Doc felt like he had never gotten a real chance in the company, but I also understood the company's perspective. It always sucked to let someone go, but it was worse when it was a friend. The whole Brawl for All competition was an utter failure, but it was also the actions of a company who was willing to push the envelope to keep the ratings moving in their favor. WWF versus WCW was a very real war with very real consequences for the eventual loser. Our locker room looked at it like they were fighting for their livelihoods. As a result, our shows became more brash, the characters more bold, and the storylines more edgy and far riskier. Chapter 61, Hell in a Cell, June 1998. Good God Almighty! Good God Almighty! They've killed him! As God is my witness, he is broken in half! It was only a few minutes into the match, and I genuinely thought my friend was dead or dying. Mick Foley wanted to top Shawn Michaels' performance at the previous Hell in a Cell match, and the way he chose to do it was by climbing to the top of the cell structure that covered the ring and goad his opponent, The Undertaker, into following him up there. Undertaker made his famous entrance and duly joined Mick 20 feet above the arena floor. The weight of both men immediately put the structure itself to the test as their collective 600 pounds tore the wire mesh under their feet as they walked. I was positioned at the edge of the cell on the floor and watched in my monitor as both men battled over to the side where Jerry Lawler and I were sitting. Beside us was the Spanish announce team led by Hugo Savinovich and Carlos Cabrera. On top of the cell, Mick and Taker threw punches and went back and forth to at the very edge to make the audience think something bad was going to happen. And then it did. Undertaker threw Foley from the top of the cell. Mick fell 20 feet through the Spanish announce team's table at ringside, his 300-plus pound body exploding into the table as his body slid limply under the guardrail. From my vantage point, Mick Foley had disappeared under the collapsed table, and I had no idea what shape he was in. Good God Almighty! Good God Almighty! They've killed him! As God is my witness, he is broken in half, I shouted. My words were real. My worry for Mick was real. My shock was real. Lawler, also stunned, was muttering, "Oh, my God. Oh, my God." I turned my attention from the audience at home to the people in the back. "Somebody get out here. Really. I mean it." As the monitor filled with replays of the fall shot from different angles, I still couldn't believe what I had just seen. All I could mutter was, "Look. Look at that, folks." Seconds went by, and Foley was still lying there, and I could feel the anger rising in me. "We need doctors out here. If somebody can get off their butt in the back and get somebody out here." But Lawler and I weren't the only ones worried about Mick. Even though they had recently been feuding on television, Terry Funk left that behind to come check on the man who he had fought and mentored across the globe. Lawler was calling for help for the Spanish announce crew, who had been in the path of the plummeting 300-pounder. Jerry noted that mankind was starting to stir as medical help finally got to Mick in the form of a doctor, some officials, and a team of paramedics carrying a stretcher. Even Vince McMahon set aside his evil on-air persona to see if Mick was okay. Mick didn't appear to be cooperating, and Terry Funk looked almost tearful as he implored Foley to get on the stretcher. I thought Mick's career was over, maybe even worse. He was alive. He was breathing. But everyone around him felt he was in bad shape. They wheeled him slowly from ringside, with the Undertaker still looking down from on top of the cell. "Apparently, as quick and unusually as this match started, it has ended," I said. But Mick didn't get the memo. The paramedics didn't get too far with the hardcore legend before he fought his way off the gurney, made it back to the cage, where once more, against all logic, Mick climbed to the top of the cell. As big as Mick was, it wasn't easy for him to scale that fence the first time, much less after the damage he had absorbed, but he made it. The fall from the top of the cage onto the ringside table was something Foley and Undertaker had worked out, but the next stunt wasn't in anyone's plans. Undertaker was to chokeslam Foley onto the top of the cage, and Foley would sell it as Undertaker climbed down and into the ring. Instead, when Foley's body hit the cell, a part of it gave way, and it swung open like a steel trap door, leaving Foley to fall all the way to the mat, back first. Even worse, the chair he had tossed on top of the cage earlier was right behind him and ended up smashing him in the face as he landed. This time, even Undertaker seemed shocked as he looked down at Foley. The doctor, referees, and medics rushed into the cell as Lawler said, "That's it. He's dead." The King, known for his sharp humor, wasn't kidding. Somehow, that impact had knocked out one of Mick's teeth, which lodged itself in his left nostril, as a gruesome camera close-up would show a few minutes later. The whole performance was scary, and I was doubly convinced the match was over. I was sure Vince was going to come back out and announce that was it, and I don't think one fan would have been upset had it ended right then. I even screamed, "Would somebody stop the damn match? Enough's enough!" But after being out cold for a minute or so, Mick was apparently looking to finish the match. The Undertaker climbed down into the ring through the opening Mick's second nasty fall had created. Funk, being the old pro that he was, took a couple of shots from Taker to buy Mick a few more seconds of recovery time. Finally, they all cleared out, and after a short brawl, Mick pulled out a bag of thumbtacks and dumped them all over the mat. Of course, the villainous Mankind's plan was foiled, as Undertaker slammed and then chokeslammed Mankind onto the thumbtacks before finally ending it with his signature tombstone piledriver. Everyone took a huge sigh of relief when the bell rang to signal the end. I was one of Mick's biggest advocates in the company, but as I sat there, I couldn't help but think Mick went way too far in that match. I admired his guts and toughness. but he never needed to get even close to that level of danger. After Mick got to the back, Vince thanked him for putting himself out there to make the show, but then added, "Don't ever do anything like that again." I had a similar conversation with Mick a couple of days later in my role as head of talent. "You're never going to be around here to make the money that's there for you," I said. "You're too entertaining and too skilled not to figure this shit out. You don't have to be Cactus Jack splattering yourself on the concrete." Mick listened to me and Vince, but I had a feeling as I shook Mick's hand, there was still that wild look in his eye, that need to give the fans what he thought they wanted from him, his body. Chapter 62, Second Attack, December 1998. "I'm sorry, honey, but your mother has passed away," my wife said over the phone. I was in England for the Capital Carnage show, a British-only pay-per-view. My mother had dealt with heart issues her entire life, and she had succumbed to a heart attack at 64 years of age. I sat in my room, tears in my eyes, remembering how she had become a big wrestling fan who never missed Raw. I thought about the work ethic she and Dad had instilled in me growing up. Vince offered to fly me home as quickly as he could make that happen. "I'm going to stay," I said. "I'm going to stay, and I'm going to do my job." "Do you want me to fly Jan here to London so she can be with you?" he asked. "No, thank you." Vince and Linda couldn't have been nicer or more supportive, but I wanted to do my work the way I had always done my work, without Jan doting on me. I wanted to grieve in my own way, do my job, and get through it. That's the man my mother raised, someone who could see the job through. The next night, Lawler and I were calling the first hour of the show when I began to feel some strange sensations. I suddenly had a throbbing headache, and the audio coming through my headphones got painfully loud. Every noise felt like it was killing me. My eye would not blink. My tongue went numb, and I began to have trouble enunciating as I lost control of the muscles on the left side of my face. We were live, and I had to support my cheek with my hand just to keep talking. I was pretty sure it was another Bell's palsy attack, even though it was a different experience than the first one. This was much more intense. As the night wore on, I was hoping it would be Bell's palsy, when the alternative might have been a stroke. I began to think that maybe I triggered the attack by putting myself under the stress of suppressing my grief, not dealing with my feelings of sadness, instead focusing on preparing for a live broadcast. Lawler noticed right away that something was wrong, but I wanted to keep going. I wanted to finish the job I'd started. It was important to me as a tribute to my mother and the son she raised. After the show, I went straight back to the hotel and packed. I knew I had to fly back and see a neurologist. I knew I had to fly back and bury my mother. When I landed, I was told that Vince got me an appointment to see a highly regarded neurologist in Connecticut. That visit confirmed that it was Bell's palsy and that they still hadn't figured out what caused it or how to cure it during the 5 years between my first attack and this one. I was prescribed prednisone and told to stay away from loud noises and certain tones that might trigger the headaches. I was also carrying around artificial tears to moisten my eye when needed. That night, I had to tape my left eye shut as I slept. I wasn't home for long before I felt depression setting in. First, it hit me that I was basically all that was left of my family. No brothers or sisters, and my parents and grandparents were all gone. My daughters were attending school in Oklahoma, but my relationships with them were not as good as I'd like for them to be. As I made arrangements for my mother, I knew the disconnect with my daughters was 100% my fault. I focused so much on my job and all the travel that I thought if I could do it all over again, that would be the only thing I'd change. As the years went by, I moved from Dallas to Atlanta and then to Connecticut. I was going farther and farther from Oklahoma while they were young women in grade school, high school, and later college. I was sure they knew I loved them, but I wish we could have had a more traditional relationship. Knowing my mother was gone now left me feeling alone. I loved her, cared for her, listened to her talk about how much she loved watching me on TV. She was kind and loved me without any conditions. She was only just gone, and I already missed her terribly. I could feel myself slipping further. I was grieving, ashamed of how I looked, and coming to terms with the distinct possibility that my on-air career was over. Appearance was important in wrestling. It always had been. I wasn't sure that WWF wanted a guy who looked like I now looked, welcoming a worldwide audience to their product, especially now that half my face was literally sagging. I knew that in wrestling, when any promoter saw a weakness, his impulse was to remove it immediately. That wasn't just a Vince McMahon thing. It was every smart booker in wrestling history thing. The more I thought about it, the more I thought I'd have to shift course and focus on talent relations or help produce my replacement on air. Announcing was the thing I loved most because when they played my Boomer Sooner music and I started down the aisle, every problem I had evaporated. It released a joy in me, a way of forgetting everything else except the story in front of me. I couldn't create that feeling a live audience gave me in any other part of my life. But now it seemed like after 24 years of doing it, and through no fault of my own, I would never broadcast again. Everything in my life was crumbling, except Jan. She minded me, tried to make me feel better. She watched my physical health tumble and my mental health follow. But she never judged, rushed, or wanted anything from me. She would go by Titan Tower and pick up my memos, payroll information, everything I needed to work from home. I knew that the more I didn't have to leave the house, the worse it would be for me in the long run. But I just didn't want to go out. I didn't want people to see me and how I looked. Working from home sounded great, but for me, I was letting my home become my personal comfort zone. I didn't want to go to the office. I didn't want to go to the grocery store. I didn't want to go out and eat. I didn't want to do anything but hide. And then Vince sent me a letter. He had somebody from the office hand deliver it to me. It read, "Dear JR, it's not the number of times you get knocked down in your life that counts. What counts is the number of times you get the fuck back up. So get the fuck back up. Give the stone cold hand sign to everyone who wants you to stay down. Use the love, respect, admiration, strength, and will of your friends and family to bolster your spirit, restore your confidence, and help you face the challenges of the future. You've come a long way, JR. You've earned a great deal of respect and admiration from family, friends, and foes. However, that was yesterday. I need you. Your family needs you. Your company needs you to help carry the WWF into the future, black hat and all. JR, you have my utmost respect, appreciation, and love. Your friend, Vince. P.S. There are 5,000 reasons for you to celebrate this Christmas in an envelope on my desk, which will be presented to you on your first day back at the office. Merry Christmas." After a few weeks of keeping myself in seclusion, I finally resolved that I could be making myself more useful. I still felt down. I still felt hurt. I still felt brittle. But on January 1st, I reported back to work after only a few weeks away. Vince was waiting with his arms outstretched. "God damn it, pal. Welcome back," he said. I didn't really want to look him in the eye because of how my face was. I didn't want him to see weakness. I didn't want him looking at me and thinking I couldn't do a job for his company. "Thank you," I said. "What for?" he asked. getting me out of the house. In addition to my existing administrative duties, I started helping to produce the announcing on Raw each Monday. I could feel the energy from the crowd through the curtain, but I didn't want to go out there. I was afraid of being mocked. That curtain became my safety net. I could stay on one side of it and kind of make myself forget that I looked the way I did. If I walked to the other side, the whole world would see. Even the thought of going out there before the people made my stomach turn. But out I went, and we tried an angle where I was a heel and Dr. Death was going to be my muscle. It didn't click. And it made me feel worse. I wasn't ready, and the people didn't know how to take me being a bad guy. We quickly scrapped it, and I hid backstage again. Michael Cole was my replacement, and even though he was newish and green, I could tell that he was going to be a hell of a talent in that position. In my mind, I was finished with the announcer's section of my career. I had no idea that the two biggest stars in the company were already talking to Vince about getting me back out there. Chapter 63, Coming Home, 1999. Hey, pal, make sure you bring your tux to Philly, Vince said the week before WrestleMania 15, featuring Stone Cold Steve Austin and Rocky Maivia, The Rock. For what, I asked. I always wore coat and tie because I was a senior company official and wanted to look professional. A tux, though, was an unusual request for an off-air talent. Because I'm going to put you back to work, Vince said. Doing what? I warily asked. You're going to call the main event at Mania, he said with a smile. You're ready. Vince patted me on the shoulder and walked away. I was thrilled to hear that he had the confidence to put me out there with that match because we all knew what we had with Austin and what we were going to have with Rock. So this main event was huge for the company. But his words also sent a cold chill down my spine. I quickly found out that Austin and Rock personally requested that I be out there. Both men and Vince wanted me to be the soundtrack to the biggest match of their lives. It was a gesture that elevated me and petrified me at the same time. I was still avoiding the world, walking with my head down, not going out unless I had to. I came to work and did my best, but left as soon as I could, just in case someone outside the core backstage team saw me. I wanted to call the matches again and made that known. But 10 minutes later, I was hunched over with shame. Shame I didn't bring on, but shame nonetheless. I was also conflicted. I was itching to get back out, but petrified that they'd ask me to do just that. I knew I was the same old JR that our audience had come to know, and I knew I wasn't him still, either. The night before the show, I couldn't sleep. I was worried about everything under the sun. How would I sound on the show? Would I be able to figure this out? Would I still have my timing? What would the crowd do when they saw me again? I can't do this, I whispered to myself. I have to quit. I was like the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, missing my heart, wishing I could get it back. I shuffled out of bed and sat chain-smoking cigarettes and popping Xanax to help settle myself. Neither worked. Are you sure you want to do this? Jan asked. No, I replied. When we arrived at the Fleet Center in Philadelphia, I sat outside for a few minutes, planning my getaway. The speech I had conjured up in my mind was pretty convincing. I was sure I could leave and make a pretty good case as to why I disappeared. But I walked forward, even though every fiber of me wanted to backpedal. Every arena, WWE set up various rooms which are designated for various things, including Vince's office, diva locker room, male locker rooms, and a talent relations room. I spent a lot of time in the talent relations room that day, just trying to stay away from everybody. It took me an hour just to put my tux on because I kept stopping and thinking, maybe I should go tell Vince I can't do this show. I cried. I lost focus. I got sick. I didn't want to be court-martialed. I just wanted my honorable discharge. I looked myself in the mirror to straighten my bow tie, and my reflection startled me a bit. Not because of what I look like now, but because of who I look like. My reflection, my hat, my eyes reminded me of my dad. As I stood there, my head started to fill with thoughts of him and his legacy, the way he had raised his only son, and my mom, how she had been a huge fan of my calls, my passion on air. Quitting would be an insult to their memory. I knew if I turned down this match that I'd be quitting what I loved for good. Professionally, if I wasn't up for calling the main event at WrestleMania, then I'd never be up for calling anything. I thought of Austin and Rock and how they wanted this match to be the best it could be, and in their view, having me out there was a way to do that. This was a match that had been building for a year, and they trusted me with it. My confidence began to rise slowly, and I started thinking, this is not who you are. This is not how you were raised. This is not the attitude that got you this far. You're not at the Irish McNeil Boys Club in Shreveport. You're not at the TBS studios in Atlanta. You're at WrestleFreakingMania. Grow a pair. Get your ass out there and do what you were born to do. I'd finally gotten myself to the point where I'd managed to piss myself off, and it was beginning to work. If this was to be my last time out there, I wanted to go out on the biggest stage of them all, calling the biggest match of them all. I washed my face and loaded my eyes with Visine because I didn't want people to know I'd been crying or think I'd been smoking a joint. I left the safety of my office and walked with purpose. My legs were braver than my mind, but I was going to do this. Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway, I thought over and over. People passed with greetings of, good luck, JR. Welcome back, JR. Ready or not, it was time to saddle up. Rock and Austin were doing the same in their own way as they waited for their cue. My beloved University of Oklahoma fight song, Boomer Sooner, began playing through the sound system in the arena to usher me out through the curtain. It was now or never. Please go easy on me, I thought as I took a deep breath and cracked open the curtain. I could feel the energy from the crowd, and it immediately raised my confidence a little. Don't worry if they boo you, a stagehand said from the darkness. I stopped immediately. What? You think they'll boo me? Maybe, he said. This is the city that boots Santa Claus after all. Have fun out there. I peeked through the curtain at the raucous crowd in the arena. Well, hell, I whispered to myself as I walked out to face the world again. As I walked down the aisle, the raucous Philly fans gave me a standing ovation. I tipped my hat to Michael Cole as I walked past him on the way to the announcer's table. Folks reached out for me to high-five them, and the whole arena was cheering. They didn't care how I looked. They were just happy to see me. And boy, I was happy to see them too. I sat down at the announce table next to my partner, Jerry Lawler, and put my headphones on just as he was saying that we couldn't have WrestleMania without good old JR. I said, well, King, I can't describe how it feels. The truth was, I was afraid to describe how it felt because I didn't want to get emotional on the air. 25 years of learning, making mistakes, meeting my heroes, understanding my deep flaws, being on top of the world, avoiding trouble, being truly down, laughing, moving, driving, paying my dues, leaving the farm, missing my folks, loving my wife, failing my daughters, taking risks, and calling the matches with everything I had all led to this. And it just about got too much to hold back. As I walked into the building that night, I thought this was going to be my last match. But as I walked out, happy, relieved, and truly at home, I knew it wasn't.
Afterward, by Stone Cold Steve Austin. I have been a fan of professional wrestling my entire life. As a young boy, the action in the ring, the psychology, and the storylines left an indelible impression on me as I grew up in Edna, Texas. So many memories, so many sights, but also so many sounds. I grew up hearing great announcers, but it wasn't until I discovered Bill Watts' Mid-South Wrestling that I heard the greatest. Jim Ross's voice was full of energy, enthusiasm, reasoning, understanding, and passion from day one. When he moved to the NWA, I got to move right there with him. It was an honor to have him call some of my matches. I knew through his unquestioned credibility that Jim could make a bad match better and a great match into damn near a religious experience. A few years after Jim left for the holy grail of sports entertainment, the WWF, I wound up there too. JR may have had something to do with that, because he always believed in the potential of an athletic and aggressive prospect from Victoria, Texas. Soon thereafter, the Monday Night Wars begun, and good old JR was the voice that captured all of the triumph, rage, excitement, and heartbreak of the Attitude Era. From a personal standpoint, I truly appreciate how Jim was able to seamlessly understand and explain the Stone Cold character to the world. Simply put, Jim Ross's work made people better. And he didn't just do it for me. He did it for the entire locker room. I know that along his journey, JR has suffered many personal setbacks. He was fired a time or two, which I'm sure you've read about in this book. He also comes from a tough background, and I believe it is that tough background that made him into the man he is today. He is, in my opinion, the greatest announcer to ever call a match. But more than that, he's my friend. He gave me support, advice, guidance, and was always there when I needed someone. Stay tuned, folks. Business is about to pick up.
Acknowledgements. My late wife, Jan, who was my biggest fan and the most positive voice in my life. My mom and dad, J.D. and Elizabeth Ann Ross, for allowing me to dream big. My wonderful daughters, Casey and Amanda, for enduring my crazy schedule and, at times, my unhealthy obsession for my work. Thanks for always persevering and for always loving your dad. Leroy McGurk and Cowboy Bill Watts for providing me my first job opportunity in the pro wrestling business in 1974, and for being compelling mentors to a wide-eyed country boy who loved wrestling. Vince McMahon, for hiring me in WWE in 1993, and for providing me the opportunity to grow as a professional and as a man. Your work ethic and passion for the genre, along with your vision and leadership, is unsurpassed. Kevin Dunn, executive producer at WWE during my tenure there, my fellow Oklahoma Sooners football fanatic, and who was instrumental in helping bring me home to WWE in 2017. Barry Bloom, my manager and trusted friend, who has strategically guided my career to new levels after a not-so-great start to our relationship. All the men and women in the sports entertainment world, especially all the in-ring talents who I have worked with for 40-plus years. My many broadcast partners over the years, including Michael Hayes, Bob Caudle, Tony Schiavone, Jim Cornette, Les Thatcher, the great Gordon Solie, Terry Funk, Magnum T.A., Missy Hyatt, Bobby Heenan, Gorilla Monsoon, Vince McMahon, Jerry Lawler, Paul Heyman, Taz, Mick Foley, and Josh Barnett. Scott Williams left us too soon in 2016 while working on this book, but whose contributions were invaluable. Simply getting to know Scott when he would come to Norman from Houston to do research on our project was a blessing. I have never met a bigger wrestling fan. Paul O'Brien has been the best writing partner a person could ever want. Paul's talents and sensibilities are God's gift, and my Irish friend heard my voice and captured it magnificently. To my friends, Jacob Ullman, Andrew Simon, Adam Swift, the late Daryl Ewalt, Dennis Brent, Russ Meyerson, Wallace Marsh, Barry Werner, and countless others who have befriended me over the years and who still serve as an inspiration as to what being a true friend means. My friend Bob Stoops, or simply Bobby to me, who facilitated many of my most cherished memories during his 18-plus year tenure as the winningest football coach in Oklahoma University history. Thanks, Coach, for allowing me to ride along on your amazing journey.
Acknowledgements. Paul O'Brien. To my Uncle Jimmy, who taped WWF to VHS for me, who let me come to his home to watch wrestling anytime I wanted. I wouldn't have been able to fall in love with wrestling as a kid without your kindness toward me. To Mick Foley, who answered a tweet that started a magical journey for me and my writing in the wrestling world, I'll always be grateful. And to JR, thank you for taking a risk on asking a guy who you never met to help write your life story. I've never been so honored or anxious in having the voice of wrestling living in my head for 18 months. Thank you, friend. We hope you've enjoyed this novel audio production of Slobberknocker, My Life in Wrestling, as told to Scott E. Williams by Jim Ross with Paul O'Brien. Narrated by Jim Ross. Forward and afterward by R.C. Bray. Executive Producer Michelle Katz. Executive Producer Michelle Katz. Produced by 115 Recording Studio with B Audio. Editing, quality control, and mastering by Wes Sharon. Audiobook copyright 2017 by Novel Audio. Print and ebook copyright 2017 by Jim Ross with Paul O'Brien. Forward copyright 2017 by Vincent K. McMahon. Afterward copyright 2017 by Steve Austin. Produced in arrangement with Skyhorse Publishing, Inc. If you enjoyed this audiobook and want to see our full library of fiction and nonfiction titles, please visit novelaudio.com. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.